All right, everyone, let's get started. Welcome to Hemingway's Week 4. Good to see everyone. I'm Jen Ashburn. I'm hosting this evening. There's been a slight change up. Chris Collins is going to read tonight, so you will hear his wonderful words from his forthcoming poetry book. Also reading tonight will be Sharon Dilworth and Ellen McGrath-Smith. Yeah. Looking forward to hearing everyone read. And we will have open mics, so please do sign up if you'd like to share your work with us. All right. So I did select a question. Okay. So I wanted to open with a kind of similar intellectual depth that Chris usually brings to these events. And so I'm going to share with you some things that I've kind of been working through myself, and so maybe that can be enlightening to you as well. I'm going to read some political poems. I find political poems really challenging to write, but I do find them very important and necessary, and when they work, they can be, for me, integral to changing the way I understand the world. So I'm going to actually open with an excerpt from a book of essays I've been reading, Jeanette Winterson's Art Objects, Essays on Ecstasy and Effrontery. And they've been helping me understand a little bit about my relationship with art and my relationship with literature, which is kind of translating to my relationship with political poems. So in her essay, Writer, Reader, Words, Jeanette Winterson writes, "Our unconscious attitude to art is complex. We want it and we don't want it, often simultaneously, and at the same time, as a book is working intravenously, we are working to immunize ourselves against it. Our best anecdote to art as a powerful force independently affecting us is to say that it is only the image of ourselves that is affecting us. The doctrine of realism saves us from the bad attack of otherness, and it is a doctrine that has been bolstered by the late 20th century vogue for literary biography, tying in the writer's life with the writer's work so that the work becomes a diary, small, private, explainable and explained away, much as Freud tried to explain art away. It seems to me that the intersection between a writer's life and a writer's work is irrelevant to the reader. The reader is not being offered a chunk of the writer or a direct insight into the writer's mind. The reader is being offered a separate reality. A reality separate from the actual world of the reader, and just as importantly, separate from the actual world of the writer. The question put to the writer, how much of this is based on your own experience, is meaningless. All or nothing may be the answer. The fiction, the poem, is not a version of the facts. It is an entirely different way of seeing." So these are hard words for me to swallow because I'm working on a memoir, which is all about the writer's facts, you know, factual events of the writer's life. But this is making me think a lot about the purpose of art and the purpose of all written word. So Winterson goes on to talk about Victorianism, Romanticism, and then realism. That's kind of the theme of this chapter, and modernism. So about modernism, she writes, "That is what I mean when I talk about exceptional sensibility. The true artist does have a kind of early warning system, an eminence that allows him or her to recognize and make articulate the emotional perplexities of his age. Writers who seem to sum up their time are writers who have this prescience. It is not that they make better documentaries than the rest. This is where the realists miss the point. It is that they make better poems. The emotional and psychic resonance of a particular people at a particular time is not a series of snapshots that can be stuck together to make a montage. It is a living, breathing, winding movement that flows out of the past and into the future while making its unique present. So I am going to share two political poems that I feel do that. And they aren't necessarily about places of the world we are focusing on right now. One is about 1965 Indonesia, and the other is about the partition in India and Pakistan, although that has been tense lately. But I suppose the point I kind of am exploring is the fact that these poems can resonate with us if the poetry is speaking to us, even if we don't personally connect with that particular conflict, because we still live in conflict, more so every day. All right. So the first poem I'm going to read is by Jedi Sophronius from his book Interrogation Records, and it is about 1965 Jakarta. So I don't mean to be a Debbie Downer. They are kind of sad poems, but hopefully I'm going to bring it back up with Jeanette Winterson's words at the end. In 1965, Jakarta, the government was seeking out and killing anyone who might have any slight association with the Communist Party, and also residents in Indonesia who had Chinese heritage. This poem by Jedi Sophronius is called Reports on the Land. He uses this technique where the text is scratched out. So when I come across that, I will read the text and say no, and then read the correction. It'll make sense once I get going. Right. Reports on the Land. We receive reports of PKI no chickens being slaughtered in many areas. A missionary who returned said she had seen 25 bodies, no chickens, in the river. Another missionary said he had seen 29 chickens in the same river. The largest slaughter was reportedly 15,000 communists, no chickens. According to numerous sources, killing of chickens continues in villages. Wounded chickens released from Surabaya had refused to return to their homes. Some railway stations had closed because workers were afraid of coming to work since many chickens were murdered. Both in the provinces and in Jakarta, repression of the chickens continues, with the main problem being that of what to feed and where to house the chickens. Many provinces appear to successfully meet this problem by executing their chickens or by killing them before they were captured. East Java, general pattern unclear. On one hand, in Kadiri, where chickens have been decimated, military reportedly seeking to stop the killings. On the other, in Pasuruan, where chickens have not been completely cleaned up, military still reportedly turning its back and allowing the slaughter to continue. The different islands deal with the chickens in various ways. In some camps, they are starved to death or released periodically to be killed by the local citizens. Bali has become more beautiful without chickens. It was the duty of the Balinese to clean their own island from chickens. It was a holy duty, and we did it. So we dragged the chickens down this hill. If they didn't want to be dragged, we threw them. If we hadn't drunk chicken blood, we would have gone crazy by now. Many went crazy. Some killed so many chickens they went crazy. One man climbed a palm tree each morning to do the call to prayer. He killed too many men, no chickens. There was only one way to avoid it, drink the chicken's blood or go crazy. It was both salty and sweet, chicken blood. He didn't want to kill his own sister, no chicken, so he sent her to me. Yes, he sent her to me. Every time the truck came, they took another 30 communists, no prisoners, no people, no chickens. I didn't help. I didn't take a machete and slaughter the chickens. I was told they were bad chickens. What's more, they never prayed. In 1965, chickens rushed to the mosques because they were afraid of being slaughtered. Once, I brought a communist head, no, chicken's head, to a Chinese coffee shop. The Chinese screamed, "You brought a chicken's head?" "Yes." "To frighten the Chinese?" "Yes, so they'd be scared." "Just to scare them?" "Just to scare them." There are many ghosts here because many chickens were killed here. They died unnatural deaths. Here was the paramilitary office where I always killed chickens. In the end, I'm disturbed in my sleep, maybe because when I strangled chickens with wire, I watched them die. So it is an intense poem. I am going to follow it up with another intense poem, but in a different way. This poem is by Fatima Ashgar from If They Come For Us. And this is about the 1947 partition between India and Pakistan. And it's a kind of Mad Lib. There's like fill in the blanks where she just left parts of speech that the reader could fill in. And, you know, given the subject matter, you could fill it in with India or Pakistan, but my point is you could probably fill it in with almost any country. Okay. Partition, August 15th, 1947. At the stroke of midnight, country achieved freedom, resulting in an adjective celebration. Both country and country fought for many months to come to this agreement, and now that the proper noun are gone, the proper noun people celebrate their victory. We end today a period of all noun, and country discovers herself anew, said proper noun in a public speech to great cheers of slogan. With country's promises of the security of the proper noun region and its borders, country's citizens verb to put the unfortunate events of the last few months behind them, and verb with their neighbors. Though millions past tense verb, leaders assure noun and future prosperity alongside cooperation with the military. Proper noun people are advised to shed fear and verb the new country. Proper noun vowed that members of all religion are welcome in country, but asked religion to honor the country's flag. However, if you are planning to leave for country, please do not forget to surrender your plural noun and ration cards, noun and noun, at the proper noun railway station. We wish you peace and noun slogan. All right, so that I just don't leave you completely in despair. I guess I did feel compelled to just write about or read about the state of conflict in our world without necessarily reading poems directly about Israel and Iran and Ukraine and some of the areas of conflict right now. But I do want to close with Jeanette Winterson. This is from her essay, Art and Life. The healing power of art is not a rhetorical fantasy. Fighting to keep language became my sanity and my strength. It still is, and I know of no pain that art cannot assuage. For some, music, for some, pictures, for me, primarily poetry, whether found in poems or in prose, cuts through the noise and hurt, opens the wound to clean it, and then gradually teaches itself to heal. So that is Jeanette Winterson. I definitely recommend this book, Art Objects, if you haven't read it. Thank you for your patience. Thanks. We have three great readers tonight, and I'll hand it over to Joan.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi. Hi, everybody. I'm really happy that you are all here, and I'm really happy that it's not too hot in here. It's not too terrible. I'm going to just open by reminding you of the tip jar for our friends who are our servers, and if you could please, even if you've maybe gotten a beer or something or some meal, if you could put in a dollar, if possible, or something, and pass this around and then try to get it up to the front at the end of the evening. Thank you. So Jen and I actually were thinking about somewhat the same lines, and I wanted just to remind you of a book that was published a couple of years ago. It was edited by Daniela Buccelli, Wendy Scott Paff, and Cherise Pollard. It's called Show Us Your Papers. It's an anthology. It was very, very well done, and it's not easy writing a political poem, and people could write them. It's easy to write them, but it's writing one that really resounds and that has an impact and reaches the heart and the mind. It's a tough thing to do, and I think a lot of the ones in here do this. If you're interested, I happen to have three copies up here. They're free. If you'd like to take one, if you don't have this anthology, you might want to just have it, because this might be a moment in which people are finding themselves wanting to write poems that have something to do with contemporary events, have something to do with the history that's unfolding around us. And again, Daniela, Wendy, and Cherise, and Daniela sent these along for us. So I am thrilled to have these three amazing writers reading here tonight, I was about maybe a year ago or so, I heard Sharon Dilworth read. I think it was at White Whale, and I'd actually never heard her read before. And I was really struck by what a great, wonderful writer she is. And she is the author of three short story books. And she is a recipient of numerous awards, including a National Endowment for the Arts grant, a Pennsylvania Council of the Arts grant, Pushcart Prize for Fiction. She is the director of Carnegie Mellon's University's Creative Writing Program, and her latest novel, To Be Marquette, is that right? Marquette, was published by Carnegie Mellon Press in 2024. And she's our first feature reader tonight. Please welcome Sharon Dilworth.
Thanks, everyone, for coming. I'm going to read a newish story. It takes place in Pittsburgh on a really, really hot August day. I'll try to remember that. And it's called Processional. Sure. The groom, on this too warm Pittsburgh afternoon, tells us how much he admires his parents, especially the fact that for 32 years they have made their bed together, never a day missed. I want nothing more from my new life with this beautiful woman, he tells us. It seems a lowly ambition for someone entering the holy bonds of matrimony for the first time. The bride, we know, wants more. She's hoping for much, much more. A coal barge chugs down the Monongahela River, heading towards the confluence of the three rivers that define our city. The barges navigating our waterways are slow-moving crafts that reach speeds of 8 miles an hour when there are no winds, and there are always winds. They look like lazy vessels, as if the captain and crew have fallen asleep and are drifting downriver like an unmanned raft on a summer afternoon. We are friends of the bride and know that she is an ambitious woman. No one would call her ruthless, or rather they might, but probably not on her wedding day. Her ducks, except for that one that is way out of whack, have always been in perfect rows. Barges in the 19th century were made entirely of wood. the shipping companies would load them down with tons of coal, knowing that some would wreck during the long river journeys. There was nothing to be done when that happened. The barges would smash up against the bridges and riverbanks, spilling every bit of their cargo. The ones that did make it to their intended destination were broken apart and sold as lumber. We are a Quaker-founded state, and anyone who wants to unite couples can do so, simply by declaring themselves able, the power vested in them. A cousin of the groom is the officiant today. She projects loudly, as if she fears not being heard, though we are only seated a few feet from the wisteria-covered canopy. The flowers look real, but we know they're not. They're silk. We are not comfortable. The sun, the heat, the platitudes of an eager groom who is cute but clueless. There is some guilt, as if this whole thing is our fault. We're not sure what to do, if anything. If the ceremony still included that vital question, should anyone present know of any reason that this couple should not be bound in holy matrimony, speak now or forever hold your peace? Might have some direction. It would give us some direction. But without it, we keep quiet, shifting back and forth, side to side, in our uncomfortable rented chairs. But here's the truth. This is a wedding with ulterior motives. River traffic might seem an old-fashioned or outdated means of transportation in the new century. Shipping companies have been moving goods via similar barges for almost two centuries. But even today, it is an extremely economical one, still one of the cheapest ways to move goods from one place to another. You could call this wedding an act of revenge. The bride, our friend, is out to punish someone. We've known her for years. Pittsburgh is a tight community. Friends are made early and kept for life. And we know that she is marrying this nice, very cute guy because she wants to make someone else jealous. And if he won't feel that emotion, she wants Forrest to know that she will no longer be there for him. Forrest Brooks. It's who the bride is in love with, who she has always been in love with. Forrest Brooks is an apt name for an unrequited love story. It is also a name that she has tattooed on her left ankle, and one that doesn't raise suspicions necessarily, whereas having something like David Smith tattooed on your leg might need some explaining. Just recently, she went over to the tattoo shop on the south side and added the words lake and tree under forests. Now it's just an appreciation of nature. Barges don't have engines, no mechanism for propelling them forward. They depend on tugboats that either push or pull them. The bride met the groom on a dating app. We're not sure which profile she used. Maybe woman in love with another man, looking for a man to pretend to be my husband to make other guy jealous. Maybe that's the one she used. We are pretty sure, made so more after all these cliched and these unusually long vows, that this groom has no idea of the bride's deception. She pretends to like him. She says and does the right thing, at least most of the time. They do have sex. She doesn't elaborate, and we don't ask. Well, we did, just to make sure that she wasn't being a total shrew. She at least sleeps with him, from time to time, is how she put it. We've been out with them, and she isn't mean, or rather, sometimes she is, but he thinks it's part of her charm. I love that sarcastic humor of hers, he says. Well, I shouldn't have to tell you. You're her oldest friends. That we are. Tugboats have small crews, two or three, and if the shipping company is particularly strapped, just one. You often see the barges stopping at strange points along the river. They do this because the captain is catching up on sleep. It's not like they can dock, so they sleep where and when they can. The bride has been crazy about Forrest for as long as we can remember, and we can't really remember when it started. She'll tell you that they dated, but that sounds like a story that she's told herself so often that she might believe it. Forrest is a wanderer, a free spirit. The rest of us graduated from high school, went to college. Those of us who had left Pittsburgh came back. We got jobs, we got married, we started having kids. Not Forrest. He dropped out senior year. Maybe he got a GED. He's always got a full backpack. Things include a paperback of Herman Hesse, a harmonica that we've never heard him play, and a journal that looks like it spent a few summers in the Atlantic. He's lived for a long time in Peru, then Nepal, then Eastern Russia. The one time we went to pick him up at the airport after he had been trekking in Peru, the odor from his body was so rank that we made him get a cab and follow us into the city. He didn't care. I had some strange looks on the plane, he said. Thought it might be me. That's when we knew that he had chosen a different path. He's cleaned up since then. He hasn't stopped the restlessness. He wears leather bracelets collected from different countries on both wrists. They mean something, and we should remember what, but it's something like peace and harmony, happiness and light. He exudes that kind of energy. The bride has been known to follow him out to the airport when he's leaving town. She's chased him through the terminals, begging him not to leave her. She was detained once. It's against the law to go barefoot in the Pittsburgh International Airport. We had to go get her. They had her in a room where two security guards were trying to get her to stop crying. They hadn't charged her with anything, and they were so happy to see us. We don't blame Forrest for being so attractive. We do wish he wouldn't sleep with the bride when he comes to visit. It messes her up, and we're back at square one when he leaves. Without the locks and dams surrounding our city, the Ohio River would be about 18 inches, making it useless for anything, but especially for boat traffic. You could, if you wanted, walk across it, which would lessen the need for all those bridges, but would add nothing to the economic prowess of the city. It has been suggested that we check our attitude. Being so judgmental is unattractive, according to some. We choose to ignore this, at least for now. None of us believe she really cares for the groom. As we have noted, he's cute, but he is not the kind of guy who inspires passion, not the kind of guy who would chase through the airport. You would chase through the airport without your shoes. He's not the kind of guy you'd cling to at security check-in lines, begging on your knees to not get onto that London-bound flight that will take him to countless faraway cities for long periods of time. The river traffic today is heavy. A slug-moving tugboat pushes a line of barges down to the point. We stop and count them. Six isn't a record, but it's still an enormous ship making its way to a destination far from our city. We imagine it's going somewhere like New Orleans, somewhere near an ocean, places connected to worlds we don't see often. The tugboat pauses, seeming to sigh as if the weight and the distance is too much to consider right then. Finally, after a long rest, it moves on. A ping. Someone has ignored the pre-ceremony plea to turn off all devices. Ping, ping. We're too curious not to take a look. Is it true? Did she really do it? It's just a joke, isn't it? To answer would be to overstep into rudeness, but it's not like we can just let it go. The phone lifts quickly. Snap, 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 send, send, send. Seconds later, ping, ping, ping. I can't believe it. After all these years, never thought she'd really do something like this. We wait. Nothing more. Maybe he's come to town. Maybe he's here to whisk her away. He's late, but we have a feeling that the bride will forgive his tardiness. We make fun of the bride for loving Forrest. It's just been so many years. We think of it as a weakness on her part, an inability to understand that he doesn't want her back. She agrees. It's just what it is, she says, and shrugs, and doesn't change her desire for him. Just last year, one of the tugboats hit the Liberty Bridge downtown, and all four of the barges broke loose. It was 4:30 in the morning, still dark. The city, unaware of the potential danger of the untethered barges on their own, the Coast Guard managed to secure all but one. That one escaped, careening freely down the Ohio River, caught up in the current. The service ends with a kiss. The groom has to lean that far forward. The bride isn't helping him by moving closer. It's a short kiss. We would clarify it as a peck. Applause, applause, then champagne. The caterers emerge with glasses that shimmer in the too warm sunlight. We take glasses and drink. We know that at most weddings, the first bottles poured are the best. We ask for seconds, not wanting to risk the cheap stuff. We toast to the happy couple. Good luck, good luck, good luck, whatever that means. Here she comes, coming over to talk to her best friends. She wears a mermaid dress, very tight through the hips, with a round train that splays out at her ankles like a tail of a creature that emerged from the sea. We tell her what everyone tells a bride on their wedding day. You look beautiful. She brushes off our praise. She's heard it from everyone there. It's not original, even though in her case it's true. She takes a glass of our champagne and finishes it in two swallows, the good stuff gone down her throat. Her cleavage in that dress is deep and defined, most likely by a contouring brush that makes it look like 3D. She's been wed less than 15 minutes. Any word from Forrest, she asks. Why is it that you can never find a server with a full tray of glasses when you need them? The bride is looking out over the river. We don't see the barges, but we hear the sound of whistles, warning some craft to move out of its way. Do you think he's heard by now, she asks, laser focused, not once in all these years. In our defense, we would not have shown her the text had she not asked. It's not like we ruined anything. She never stops thinking about him. She once told us that she burns for him, a fire that never settles, never goes out. So it's not like we were to blame for wrecking the day. She leaves. For some time, we're the only ones who know she's gone. The groom looks over a few times, but it's not like we're going to say anything. There's a lot of drinking, a lot of cheering. Someone has a drone, and they keep taking pictures. We down glass after glass of the cheap stuff. Sure, we'll feel it later, but desperate times call for heavy buzz. The DJ plays One Direction, songs that seem a bit young for this crowd, but they're happy songs, and people get up and dance. They've passed appetizers. The past appetizers are tenderloin sliders, a blue cheese sauce, and a roasted red onion. We finish off several. It's when the maid of honor gets up to deliver her toast that the guests become suspicious. At first, it's a bit of a joke. She's got to be somewhere. They wait. Someone checks the bathroom. They run upstairs into the honeymoon suite. She's nowhere to be found. The groom, frantic, is not looking so cute anymore. We think it's time to go. We don't want to be questioned. The guilt is getting to us, and we will fold under pressure. The air has cooled. We walk the trail to the river's edge, going the long way to the parking lot to avoid running into other departing guests. We are silent, a long day. Headaches, but another kind of ache too. A secret, something that we never share. But it's been there since the beginning, ever since the bride fell in love with Forrest. Shapes moving down a dark river, traveling to points unknown. We would like to know how it feels. Yes, that's it. We would like to know if it's cold or slippery. Do you worry about falling, making a fool of yourself? How does it feel against your bare skin? You know, the floor, most likely linoleum out at the airport, as you go barreling and rushing after someone you have loved for countless numbers of years. You have never had any limitations, nothing that you wouldn't do to get what you want. That unwavering emotion, paying no attention, not to his rejections or to other people's disapproval, nor to our endless stories where we mocked you mercilessly, not even listening to common sense. Do you even feel the floor as you go flying by? But we don't ask. Instead, we get into our beds, pull up our sheets, and smooth out the wrinkles, all neat and tidy in our worlds.
Thank you.
I would just point out to you that if you would like to hear that again, it will be up on the Hemingway's poetry series blog pretty soon, along with the poetry and writing of other writers for the last 12 years or so. So thank you, Sharon. That was just amazing. Golly, wow. I guess I've known Ellen McGrath Smith for about almost 25 years, because she was the teacher in the first poetry class I ever took in Pittsburgh at Pittsburgh Center for the Arts, and she's such a gifted teacher and so encouraging and so helpful in suggesting that you might open up and really try new things. And that was sure what I needed. and I'm so grateful to her because I did keep writing. Ellen teaches at the University of Pittsburgh and in the Carlo University's Mad Women in the Attic program. Her work has appeared in George Review, The New York Times, American Poetry Review, the Los Angeles Review, other journals. Her books include Scatter Free, Scatter Feed, Nobody's Jackknife, and her new chapbook, Lie Low, Goaded Lamb, was published in January 2023 by Seven Kitchens Press. Please welcome Ellen McGrath Smith.
Thank you, Joan. Well, you were a delight in that class. That seems like a really long time ago. And thank you, Chris, and thank you, Jen, and thank you, all of you, for being here. It's been a while since I read. I feel a little rusty, so we'll see how it goes. Misconnections. So you all know the misconnections ads on Craigslist, where, you know, if you see somebody out in the world and you want to try to get with them. Okay, so these are my misconnections. One, I was scritching at delivery, answering a prayer. You were impressed with your hair in the inadvertent mirror of the shop window. The shop's name was, the prayer was for, is this reflection or projection? I saw you see me meaningfully. No. I am not God. Two, you were in police custody. I was getting a custard at the Rita's across from the precinct. I think you wore a Bulls hoodie. They were mistaken, the cops. Doe-eyed doesn't begin to cover it. Fringed by spider's legs. If you can get to me, I'll gladly be your witness, though I don't know what the charges are. This is not sexual, at least not of the flesh. Did you feel it too? You walked with gentleness and dignity. They wanted you to go off, a reason to hurt you. Is any of this true? Authoritarianism, all of it centered in the gut, the whole world there, in abrasions, ruminations, all of it gathering in shoulders, the strife imagined blows, the fight or flight flinch, all in hips and ache, vague but constant, dry lips, bald fists, all of it in the spine, at the root, at the crown, the vine crawl of neurons, the twig fingers typing to connect points of light. This is a poem that I shopped around for a long time, and finally Fred Shaw in the Pittsburgh Quarterly 2.0, accepted it and published it. And Joan liked it and requested it, so I'm reading it. Ghost Park. The dog took off near the backhoe, stuck in its rut, and I followed through tan brush, watching his white shape zip up the mud path. A plateau halfway up the city mountain. An abandoned basketball court, chain link strangled by vines, backboard standing indecisive above a spread of soggy beer cases, broken bottles, crinkled cans. Of course, a used condom here and there. A knockoff Weber grill that wasn't rusted. Low-slung car seats for close talk. An iron drum spray-painted death to hipster insurrectionists, which only a hipster insurrectionist would write. We saw no animals besides ourselves, but heard birds chipping away the remains of the afternoon sky. And we were happy with our discovery, happy with the water dribbling through a dubious pipe from the top of the hill where the real park was. For 5 years, the dog lived in a dark house with a sick man, starting whenever a sound from outside came too near. He guarded but couldn't stop staggering falls, jerky spills from an unsteady hand. In daytime, dark bourbony light through shut blinds. I kicked a few beer cans across the worn pavement. The dog feasted on the thaw's reactivated scents. And this is a newer poem that sort of deals with the same space in my neighborhood. It's called Two Men at a Dog Park. When lost and broken presents itself, I find and try to fix and then resent my project over time. Hence, the man with the Chihuahua, who just moved here in September from the Southwest, says, "I'm crazy to do it, it's not working out. And I want to befriend him, but will not because I recognize and fear my pattern." Woods above the park are an underground venue. Punk, I ask, where he casually tells me his granddaughter got raped by an older guy. "What did you do?" I ask him. "Nothing. She was 16, drunk and late, coming home. I thought it was just to distract me from that," he says. Sundown, nice October bite, air you could eat that would stick to your ribs and sink you down to sleep. All right, there's some language and possibly obscenity. This is called Dicks Launching Dick Rockets, with help from U.S. Representatives Robert Garcia and Jasmine Crockett. I can't unsee that porn beside his bed. While his wife was in the hospital with a baby born too early, the face of a blonde with six erect penises ranged around her mouth. We were helping to clean up, but you can only hide that stuff, not clean it. 2 decades later, can't be surprised he's a Trumper. All dicks launching dick rockets I have to pay for, and you too. That porn is how things feel in this regime change. I want to shut my mouth, but I can't. It's ultimately animal, but not at all natural, just enough half-formed ideas, enough childlike fear and fragility to make it more cruel, to turn something vital like sex into something brutal and obscene. I've been hanging out with my mom the past couple years out in the suburbs with the Alter Cockers. And so I'm sort of like, I see myself as getting the inside scoop on aging, which is probably timed pretty well. So the title is The First Line. floating clouds of Bethel Park, I join you prematurely, first in line for lunch, blanching into the walls of the Quest Lab waiting room, bobbing on the treadmill at the cardiac rehab, clotting the aisles of the Shop and Save, the line at the pharmacy, don't get me started. Cheerful as we may be, we are the clouds of weekdays, Cirrus in yoga pants, Cumulus playing hooky on the endocrinologist until our cotton candy glucose numbers dip. Stratus with some gray left, Stratus with dark streaks of resentment at the way the polar winds blow and infect us, the X-ray sun exposes our emptiness. But look how we make a sky of Earth, how we break and embrace, how our laden lightnesses soften the edges of noon. Okay, I have a compulsion, especially when I'm depressed. I play solitaire online, like ridiculous amounts of it. So this is called Solitaire, Solitaire, and it starts with an epigraph from Edward Abbey's Desert Solitaire. I am here not only to evade for a while the clamor and filth and confusion of the cultural apparatus, but also to confront immediately and directly, if it's possible, the bare bones of existence, the elemental and fundamental, the bedrock which sustains us. Don't do disbelief. Be like a rat in a Skinner box, pressing the bar for maybe the luck of a pellet. Don't swell up like the kid you were, fantasizing excellence in a competition that would finally spell out your name in gold, break the spell of dysfunction in and around you. Don't sleep on the right-hand side either. You'll miss a lot of plays that way. Run through last-minute maneuvers when it looks like you're dead. But remember, done is done, even if it takes a few dime plays to get there. Manifesting is a thing I notice. Like when I think I need a certain card and it shows up in the very next deal. Not to be confused with expectations. Assholes with guns who hope someday to use them. Tikkun Olam is another attitude to take. Each time I click on new, I activate a world to put to order. In this mindset, I'm a god, not so much invested in what happens as I am in the happening. Pairs well with mindfulness breathing, or what we used to refer to as breathing, before we became mindful of how mindful it could be. Tikkun Olam, you are not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to desist from it. What's nifty about this is how it gets around the very thing that makes people desist from it. The work is no sooner completed than a call for repair enters one's awareness. In this framework, just when I think I've repaired this scrambled deck of cards and the confetti and declaration that I am a winner fill the screen, a new animated shuffle breaks the dream. Fugue state, trance state, or maybe meditation, as long as you harbor no gaining idea, lowbrow choreography of optic muscle memory, the billiard screen simulating the natural world. No smoke, no cans of beer, just you and your exocerebrum at play. Pure waste of time. Here's a story. Kings and queens of all races subjected everyone else, except their son Jack, to chattel or chit, nameless and unjustly ranked. Everyone's existence contingent and transactional. Ace was their god, their crown, fixer, mascot, priest with the power to make emperors. In the hole, boring through the bodies of the oligarchs where souls once were, Ace was the silk thread, the silk worm, the alpha and omega, the egg and sperm. They put on democracy charades, appeared to disappear within the shuffle of elections, but there was never much doubt about who got the most ink, the most tallies, adornments, and accessories. This went on forever. The world ended only when one face, even a peon's, went missing. Then a fresh world reassembled, identical to the last, or the missing one's replica was folded into the current world. The whole thing flew by so quickly, with little time for mourning before it was time to restart. Transactions and coincidences, parts to wholes, stories to give it all some meaning. What's a god who knows themselves to be a servant in the larger world? What's a god like me to do? On the other side of this paper is a to-do list. When you win, that's just winning. When you lose, that's just losing. You're alone. How could you make it competition? I say these things to myself as I grow older, thinking time is as factual as dirt. What you make of both depends on many factors, but we love when dirt has seeds and roots and nutrients in it, and we love when time is well spent. Only this, to expect it to bear fruit, forgets that fruit is only part of it. Where do you think the dirt comes from? What if the thing you do to solve a problem from one direction leaves you open to attack from another? Thrashing, fins, and all, there's your fine kettle coming back to slap, flap, slap your conscience, peace of mind. Did you think, since you're human, your life wasn't a brief walk, hacking out a path between attack and evasion, thwack, evaporation? Where do you put your value, you who like to keep your hands so clean? Tonight, that open shower was restorative. Ginger, lemon, kombucha, a hot yoga class, restorative. Cleaning the kitchen after dinner, that too. 15 minutes in the morning, 15 minutes in the evening of breathing, not thinking, juice for the body and soul. But this thing? Save it for the times when I'm tired of being unconscious, but too weak to do more than sort some colors and symbols on a screen. Only then can this be said to be restorative. Not now, when there is so much to do and the energy to do it. Yes, I've been beaten up by the year. There have been losses, new demands, a reconfiguration of my roles. It's hard to let go of my fear, to let go of the sense that I'm sustaining, even building a career. I'm over 60 and I have to let it go. Am I ready to retire? No. I have much more to give and can't afford to. So this thing I've been doing compulsively for months, my non-restorative means of calming monkey mind, or simply getting monkeys to walk in single file, monkey business. I forgive myself for it, but henceforth, once a week at the most. Everything in my life is shifting. This is not a way to swim, but it's a raft, and I've floated for days through sun and gloom, out in the open or alone in my room. I never cried for help, though I did await rescue as I pried open spaces to help myself, distracting myself while I did. Then there's a little picture. There are little screenshots of different games. This one, this game is called The Virgin Dies Young. The virgin dies young at the awakening of desire. She's a stalk with a heart so full, it feels like two beat deep inside her. Her fingers so slender, they'll never bear the weight of a diamond. The king is her father and can abide no other near his hard-won throne. The virgin dies young at the sound of the doorbell, spaded by shame, when the king in his cups interrogates the suitor, whom she is unable to look in the eye. The virgin dies of exposure to the green of her years, mowed to stubble all around her, to the columns of fears in her mental ledger. The virgin knows death like acid rain on her tongue keeps it near. The virgin dies so many times young, she starts to rank the deaths in order, red and black and crisp in her memory. Older, she will mix them up and spill them on the floor. Older, she will find her own first corpse and cover it with every flower. The queen is not your friend unless you're useful to her. You could die in her red war with the red king, and her rings pity her the weight of all those jewels, those chunks of earth that marry her to mortal. Cherish the coal your bitter tears wash from your pores. Each day is new, and so are you. And I'll close with this poem. It's called Good Night, Good Night, Emails. Command Shift Delete. You have served your time in the light of my attention. Namaste and all that. Good night, socials. Force quit if I have to. People are amazing. People are awful. And everyone longs to be an animal with conditions. Good night, Wordle. Girding up for neural pathways, yellow vellum, Fanny Burney's Camilla. At 900 pages, these people are under my skin. Good night, Netflix, the Kool-Aid of adulthood. All those pictures in the 60s, bottoms dry like pixie sticks at first, defunct haboobs of sugar a douse with the kitchen faucet, summer day after summer day. Good night, Microsoft Word for Mac. You had me scared after my upgrade to Sonoma that no M-dash could be had in fewer than 2 steps. Got that sorted. May the people under 40 understand how much our backs hurt in the days of typewriters, how reluctant we were to do revision. Get back to me when you run out of ribbon to write your paper, or have to start from page 1 just to add something between 5 and 6, so now everything is a new beginning. And Stein, who made her girlfriend do her typing, was able to come up with her continuous present, her beginning again and again, with no direct experience of the hell that is typing a large manuscript in process. Good night, Alice. Wake up to a scribble-free breakfast prepared for you, for once, by someone as fastidious as you. Gertie changed the Enterprise, but let's give credit where it's due. Good night, calendar, solitaire, Google Docs 2, good night, browser, Zoom, SharePoint, OneDrive, iTunes, Team. It is time for the brain inside my head to hear itself apart from work, apart from wrestling with the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, apart from survival or the briar patch other people. It is time for words and no words, for a recumbent skeleton, for what I think are prayers, but feel like flowers blooms. Good night, for it is time we had a rest. Good night, Wi-Fi, and whoever's spying, fuck you too. Good night, uppity Adobe, desktop, trash can, I love you.
It is thrilling to hear poetry like that. It's so inspirational and mind-blowing and exciting. And thank you so much, Ellen. I'm just like, wow. And more to come. Okay. The series that you've been part of here for a few years is really made possible because Jimmy Savedic said, you know, I think if I'm not going to be able to do this anymore, you should have Chris help you and do it with you. And that was my idea too. And so it was not a hard decision. It wasn't. This series really is what it is because of Chris Collins and the fact that he knows so many people. He knows the quality of their work, and he really has opened this series up, and I'm so grateful for all that. Now, for the bio. Okay, Christopher Collins is the book editor, as you might know, of Pittsburgh Magazine. He lives in Stanton Heights with his wife, Anna, and two adorable and lively children. He has a new book coming out, Vesper Room, from Kung Fu Treachery Press, really soon. And yes, he is the co-curator of this series, and thank heavens. Please welcome Christopher Collins.
Hello. Hi. Thank you, Joan, for that. Thank you very much. None of that's true. This series is great because of Joan. I just hang out here and drink beer, which I'm qualified to do. Thanks for you guys for coming out tonight. We had some really hot nights last season, and we weren't sure how it was going to feel in this space tonight, but the fans are on. The garage doors are closed. It's pretty comfortable, so thank you for being here. Joan and I really appreciate it. Thanks to Don, doing the sound, recording everything. Yes. If you've never been on the Hemingway's blog site, please check it out. It's like over 20 years of recordings or something like that. Well, I mean, I'm going to say it is. I don't care what you say, Joan. It's over 20 years. If Jimmy can say, we've been here 50 years, whatever, I can say 20 years for that. So check them out. Excellent, excellent stuff on there. Thanks so, so much to Hop Farm for having us. Thanks to Eric, our server tonight. Tip him well. And so much thanks to Jen Ashburn for filling in tonight and hosting. Thank you so much. Thank you, Jen. Okay, I'm going to read some poems. I was never a missed connection. I worked in bookstores and libraries for many, many years around the public, and I was never a missed connection. And being a romantic at heart, that always disappointed me. I was, however, the subject of a lot of negative Yelp reviews, so it kind of balances out. So, which I think you can still read. Okay, I'm going to read a few poems. Bear with me. This is called Election Season. Oh, it's a Bloomfield poem. Sacred Heart of Jesus is closed, but on the other side of Liberty, the boys at Baby Loves Tacos are stuffing burritos under blackout conditions. This obscene heat wraps lascivious legs around Bloomfield's frying bottom. Where the street bends, cold beer waits. Where the air is thickest is where our brains turn to pudding. Coagulated a red rust, this is not the color of justice, is what we expect. I feel God's thumb pushing down on our heads like dull tacks into this offended earth. They keep Narcan behind the bar so we don't have to watch anyone OD for too long, and for that we tip very well. The sallow-faced summer didn't choose to be a preamble to another election. It's something we burn into its already raw skin. It's our revenge on the season, our latest stab at burning the damn thing down. This one is called Pineapple Eddie. Pineapple Eddie is a restaurant up in Erie. Here again, I have run aground in the sand and squinting sun of Erie, PA. The lake is pretty good, I admit, if not great, and my feet steam and smoke as I cross to the water's weedy edge to scoop up one child or another. The reclining slab of ink and red meat on the blanket to our right has many harsh, incredulous words for the anti-gun crowd, and I worry how much more heat his exposed and sizzling brain can take. Settle down, man. Settle down. Watch the water and the light contorting across it, and the osprey circling, lazy as a stopped drain, while our children poke at dead fish and sand toads with short sticks. My son gathers broken snail shells while my daughter rolls in the surf, her smiling mouth burping out primordial muck. Later, at the restaurant, our children are stunned to find silverware wrapped in paper napkins. What is this? They exclaim. It's the very definition of fancy. My wife and I drink sweet beers and cool our bodies in the lapping AC. We try to love each other from opposite sides of this booth, our kids jumbled and jangling between us. We probably overpraise the meal, but for the moment, it really is wonderful to eat the fried chicken and plantains. The walls are down, and the swell of love speckled in rough sandy surface all over us, our toes and ears ringing our sunburnt necks way the hell up our asses. Each of us glad for it, glad for each other, momentarily safe from the rest of this cracked and rage-filled country here in Pineapple Eddy. Down the street here, a few blocks, is a bar called The Abbey. It used to be a lot of things. Currently, it's a bar. It is one of my preferred and conducive writing spots and has been for many, many years. A lot of the poems in the book that's coming out were written there and are about that spot. This is one of them. This is called Hymns and Hers, and Hymns is spelled H-Y-M-N-S. Hymns and Hers. That's how they mark the restroom doors here, Hymns and Hers. When I was a kid, this bar was a funeral home. Prior to that, a foundry. Frank J. Boyle cut the marble here and delivered the headstones to the lithe grass of new plots in Allegheny Cemetery, not 50 steps from this door. Later, Boyle sold the land to Wayne Brass, who spit out metal castings intently as you would tobacco juice, and with the same shimmery pearl of pleasure, too. Brass paid no mind to the dead, simply shooed them away like neighborhood dogs. Werner Lutz had the place as I remember it, buying the mortuary cleanly off his brother-in-law. Lutz also owned Stephen Foster's old homestead on Penn Avenue. Made that a funeral home, too. The dead have always been good business. It would change hands again, shaking off the Reagan years as good funeral home and cremation service. A man called Beinhauer said the spot had some beautiful stained glass and some antique-type items that really kind of added to the overall decor. Eventually, the joint became what it is, just like the rest of us did. But all the fresh paint in the world and a good-looking bartender can't change the view from my stool. Acres and acres of the dead, waiting, waiting, waiting. This is called Almost 50. I'm 51 now. I came to drink my foul mood out of the shallows, into the deep where I hope to see it drown. I am drifting among glasses, as Seamus Haney would have it. The women at the back table are talking Oppenheimer. They are belly deep in that brutal age, their cocktails cooling in the half-light. History is kind to no one. Here where the clock hands fall in reverse, here is the sum total of my wisdom. Even Paul Westerberg got old, Even Alex Chilton died. The door swings open. The door swings shut. This is called I Used to Live for the Summers. Featuring 9 o'clock wines, also down the street. Go buy some wine down there sometime. I say to Celine, I just want my son to stop yelling at me all the time. She laughs at the joke that is not a joke, and I pay for the bottle of wine and leave. This fucking sun. 90-something degrees on Butler Street. Again. Jesus, what's with this traffic? It's barely 2 o'clock. Thursday. Where are they coming from? Where are they going? I need a drink. A drink and a good book and air conditioning. I need better prospects. I need a plan. I need my son to understand where I'm coming from when I say no one ever gets what they want all the time. I want him to understand this world means him harm. Wolves lurk everywhere. But fuck me, it is hot. This is not what July was like when I was a kid. It was long and languorous. It was hot, sure, but we'd line up at the spigot outside my grandmother's house, douse our steaming heads, and we'd get back to it, go running and shouting down the alley, spy on the neighbors who never pulled the shades and walked around naked. We'd lose pop-ups in the old maple, leap from swings into the ether, trusting we'd fly up, 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 always up. We'd crash into the hard-packed earth, laughing and bleeding. We grew up kind of shitty, but it was good. I love my son. Even when he shouts in my face, shrieking that I am wrong all the time. I used to live for the summers. Not so much now. I tell strangers that my daughter will be the death of me. But my son, my beautiful, big-hearted, gorgeously cruel son, my son, I say, my son, he breaks my heart. This is called Parenthood. My son does something, and I start yelling. My daughter won't sit still, and I completely lose my shit. I am unrecognizable to myself. My parents did what they did, and I love them. Forgiveness is something else. I'm ashamed of my behavior more often than I'd like. I fail, and I fail again. I never get any of it right. The constant refrain of parenthood. I'm sorry. I love you. Forgive me. Okay. Here's a poem for Bob Paycheck. Call it Poem for Bob Paycheck. The O's are up, but the Yankees are the Yankees, so they can buy their way out of a loss and into the postseason. And Ozzy on the radio is unequivocal. He's coming home. And here I am in this shiny new money pit on Butler Street, eating an overpriced cheeseburger when I get the news. Bobby, I didn't know your mother. I just knew the man she raised. The day is too hot for early May and much too sad. We were just talking last night, me and Anna, trying to catch up between us, which isn't easy with the two kids planting endless flags in our limited attentions. And there's Anna's job, too, and if I'm being honest, my own not-there-ness, which is becoming a problem. We got into another fight this morning when she mentioned a free concert in the park, and I was noncommittal. My brain somewhere else working out all the things I needed to do today in the meager time I had to do them, and thinking about the weekend was simply beyond me. Last night, Anna wanted to know how you were doing. We'd been talking about Bart, when she asked about you. I said I thought you were better. Your mom, at least, was back home from the hospital, and things were better. Now I know I was wrong. Wrong as a swing on a leadoff pitch. Wrong the way Randy Rhodes wound up. Baseball and rock and roll, Bobby. They keep involving themselves in this poem. When today should only be about your heart, that big bruised thing that is constantly breaking chairs and amazing all of us. Oh, Bobby, 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 what is wrong with this world? Why are we cursed to outlive the ones who know and love us best? Nothing makes it easier. Nothing makes it better. The O's are doing their best, but it's too early to say how any of it will go. I guess you could say that about us, too. These old songs keep playing, Bobby. They all say, I love you. Goodbye, goodbye. Here's a poem for Joan. This is called Giulietta Messina, who's an actress in a lot of Fellini movies. Hey, Joan, word just came an old friend won the Pulitzer for his poems. This is true. Which I hate to admit, I haven't read yet. Funny how that yet implies something that just between you and me probably won't happen. Another friend is on her way to Gaza. My wife says it's as part of some German-backed medical mission. Margaret, always trying to save everybody. Here I am, safe and anonymous, in an empty bar waiting on the bus. Later, I'll say something wholly inadequate to Bobby. Scott wants to know what we should wear. A tie, I think, I say. Joan, I've been trying to get home all afternoon, but the bus won't have it. Sit there, it tells me. Don't move. And so here I sit. And since I'm thinking of you, I'm also thinking about your Fellini poems. Really, it's Giulietta Messina on my mind. Pope Francis said something about her gaze, how she knows how to capture in winter what is already spring. Oh, Joan, how the road goes. In your poem, you describe Messina as clown-faced light in the face of darkness. No offense to the Pope, but I think you hit closer to the truth. Fellini called her lo spipoio, small, tender thing. Yes, that's it exactly. That is what all of us need right now, a small tenderness. Bobby, maybe most of all. Just a couple more. This is for one of my friends and one of my favorite local poets, Bart Sularchek. It's called Poem for Bart Sularchek. First, there is the sun. Then there is no light at all. There's the first beer, then another. Then it's, where the hell am I? First there is someone you love, then it's just you alone again. John Ashbery asked, where shall we meet up afterward? Bart, wherever it is, I hope everyone we ever loved gets the ticket, and they're too happy drunk to care how time and again we fucked it all up. They just want to push open the doors, Bart, and light the way home. Okay. Two more. Have you ever been in a place where you've just been like so single-minded and so like distracted by your own shit that you don't know what's going on around you, until suddenly you do. That's what this poem's about. This is called Trying to Read Larry Levis at Drag Brunch, September 28th, 2024. It's possible I have made a mistake. Usually quiet with a nice view of the cemetery here in the early Saturday afternoon drizzle, the DJ is pumping Chapel Roan's Pink Pony Club, and the bachelorette party to my left is practically ablaze. All of them ready to jump up on the unsteady high tops and demonstrate every benefit that comes with the absence of shitty men. The queen with milky coffee skin glows in gold sequins with her boosted decolletage to her pretty sparkling toes. She's making it hard to consider the plight of migrant farm workers in 1960s California. But surely, Cesar Chavez could get with this. I page around, landing on Larry's Billie Holiday poem, glancing at another queen's tight gown. I say to no one, "Yes, here is the late style of fire. Here is the burning, and the beauty of the thing engulfed." Later, I will not lack for poetry, and my wife and I will scorch the sheets. Thanks again for listening. Up here is a sign-up sheet for the open mic. If you're so inclined, please join us. This is the last poem. This is the title poem, The Vesper Room. It's like 1,000 people have just left the room. That's what Pete Hamill said when Sinatra died. When they found Jude's body, I didn't say much of anything. I was too hurt. Too angry. I remember you said about your father, when it was clear there would be no stopping the inevitable, you asked, "Why not order the good whiskey for once?" He smiled at you and said, "Why change me now?" Mary Oliver wrote, "Oh, to love what is lovely and will not last." Tonight, I am remembering everyone. This raised glass of the good stuff overflows with forgiveness. Enough, maybe for us all. Thanks a lot.
Now, it is my joy and pleasure to let you know what's happening in 2 weeks. Because otherwise you might forget. And God willing, we will have 5 poets next time, you know. And they will be, we hope. It is summer, so anything can happen. Halsey Heyer, Gail Langstroth, Mark Neeson, Stefan Triplett, and Anne Trubeck. And I don't think Anne is a poet, is she? That's right. That's right. Okay. That's right. Okay. So that is good. That's really going to be exciting. I hope you'll be here. We're going to take I would like to point out there are books for sale over here. We're going to take a brief break while we do the photo. And that's going to require the poets to be Sharon and Chris and Ellen to be up here and Jen and do the photo, and then we'll come back for the open mic. But I do hope that if you don't have copies of Sharon's books, or you don't have copies of Ellen's, I think they're available. Did you bring any tonight? You did. Okay, and Chris's too. So, and there are a couple of the anthologies up here for free. So here's the open mic, and see you in a couple of minutes. Okay, a few minutes. Okay. Woohoo! Thank you all. Okay. Poets up here.
Okay.
wonderful reading. And now we have some wonderful open mic readers. So starting off, Margaret Casper Reed. Come on up.
All right, so I thought I had this marked. Let me see. You know, in this time when we're all losing our funding for everything, I have been a teacher all my life, and the funding going for the teaching has just broken my heart. And let me find this. Oh my gosh, where is it? The Mozart Theater. Oh my gosh. Pedals down Water Street. Okay, good enough. Okay, so this was a chapbook that I had done. I was saying to Ellen, I lived in upstate New York for 71 years. And I've been in Pittsburgh for 2 years. And I love hearing your connection to Pittsburgh. And my connection to the city I lived in was this chapbook that was Laments Grocery, which was a store that I passed on a certain route every day. And I always thought, Laments Grocery, you know, we take out lament to be a great thing. But anyways, Elmira becomes a character in the book, but this is a school poem, I guess. After Nick retires from driving the school bus, Elmira plans to pick up his route. She becomes a character. On this, his last day on the job, he eyes the children through the rearview mirror. At each stop, he pulls the doors open, reaches into his sweater pockets, and hands each child a newly minted silver dollar, one of 30 he purchased at the Chemung Canal Bank at lunchtime. Thanks. See ya, Nick. Take care, a few say. They leap over the steps, sneakers barely touching. Back at the middle school, the principal announces to the teachers cuts in staffing. Her face collapses. She tears up, bites her lip, then sobs, bawls, huge, blubbering oceans of tears. Her weeping in the library splashes the teacher's feet, sogs the institutional carpet, drenches all the posters telling everyone to read anytime, any place, bollocks up the locker combinations, ruins all the blue Bic note pages in spiral binders, salts the potatoes boiling in the cafeteria pots. The cafeteria ladies float on a tidal wave of tears down corridors, rushing out of the side door, bobbing like small white ships on what was once a baseball field, but now has become a small, sorrowful inland sea.
Thank you, Margaret. All right, Arlene, come on up.
So I'm indulging in sentimentality here. I wrote this for Jimmy Savedic when he was still living and had just had a heart problem. back in 2007. Heart for Jimmy Svedek. Jimmy brings the mic into the box where the paneling is tired from smoky nights and the pool players stop their chock chock. He read us a poem once about internet sex, men with women, women with women, men with dogs, knows the ropes, the rules, but steps over the chalked lines of money and the schools, doesn't see them. In the break between featured readers, Jimmy introduces the kid he's training. High cheekbones, a glow off him, dark brown lion in the headlights, and we yellow like paper. Jimmy holds up the basket of tips for the waitress, plugs the kid's match, and calls the featured reader. But any poet can oil up and flex with contenders in Jimmy's hospitable light. Jimmy contends there's no such thing as a bad poem. He knows there are bad actors. He's arrested some. And maybe a poem will dance backward, light on its feet, land its blow, and maybe some poets will glow at the bell in the ring where Jimmy will introduce them if they'll go.
Thank you, Arlene. It's kind of a very fitting poem for this series. And next up is an incredible miscreant, Jason Irwin.
Hi, this is a in-progress poem. It's called Metamorphosis. A chill settled in my bones as I stood on the corner facing St. Demetrios, waiting for the light to change. It was February, overcast. The plastic grocery bags full of soppressata, sliced provolone, and pint bottles of Russian lager twisted around my thumbs like Chinese finger cuffs. That's when I noticed it. My father's left hand jutted from my jacket sleeve, gnarled and bulbous, like some misbegotten root vegetable. When I locked eyes with the man working at the halal truck a few blocks away, my entire left arm transformed into my father's. Did he notice this slow-moving metamorphosis? How my face palsied with fear? What about the woman scrounging for cigarette butts, or that dog tied to a parking meter? As the N train thundered overhead, I hurried past the diner and bank where the homeless gypsies lay sprawled in the ATM lobby after a night of reverie. At my apartment, drenched in sweat, my arms heavy as anchors, I floundered, trying to open one of the beers. Out of the corner of my eye, a cockroach appeared, like an ancient oracle. Its antennas twitched as it leered at me from the corner, from the counter, sorry, with a bemused severity, as if to say, get a hold of yourself. This happens to everyone.
Thank you, Jason. And bringing us home, thanks again for everyone for being here. Paul. Yep. Nope. Paul. Oh, I'm sorry. Paul. And what is your last name? Palsy.
Howdy. 23 total lines this evening, two epigraphs, which are titled, and two short poems. Epigraphs first. Walk, Jung as in Carl. Walk Around Oxygen title. The Chronic Margarita and a Jung. An incomplete on stuff that does not spell. Selfishly bled out is Pig Latin moot. Do we embalm once or use more cheese whiz? Class action hoopty, bought as in robocall. Low-hung fruit, candidacy, and argyle. Seasonal, effective deodorant. Fox News monologue, red, white, QVC. Signage in the queue as an alias. Data harvest abort, tap screen result. No pundit for office, just want this bot. Together, everything annoys me. Epigraph, just like you said. A thang shoey joystick, GameStop curio, toadstool Muppet, and Dagburn effigy. How I shrivel the eternal costume. Comparable pretext, lake farm eggplant. Last poem is Ah Fooey. Light haze may forecast apparent galosh. Why can't we just get in the running car? Sprinkle fish food at an aquarium. Multi-nucleotide polymorphism. Christen it illusion of stewardship. I love you unimportantly as rice. Let those who earmark ameliorate, they profit weak. Before viscous held bath. Thank you.
So again, thank you so much for coming out. It was lovely tonight. What a great evening. Wow. Thank you to our readers. Wow, thank you to our audience. Yippee. Okay, thank you, Mr. Sturica. Thank you, Hop Farm. We'll see you real soon. If you're not somehow on the e-blast, feel free to come by and write your name and your email, and you too can know more than you ever thought possible about the Pittsburgh poetry scene. Thank you all. You take care.